Well, I hope you'll notice that I've titled my talk Deactivating Peripheral Nerve Triggers, Surgical Solution to Refractory Headaches. Migraine's not even in the title. We'll get to that. We all need to give our disclosures nowadays. I have no financial disclosures related to migraine surgery. I have founded a number of biotech companies related to other technologies. I have one very special acknowledgement, Dr. Lisa Frere, who's here today. She came to us from the medical university here in Vienna and for her PhD after MD, and we were very fortunate to get her involved in this work. And she really is the formal director of all the research you're going to hear about, came up with many of the innovations, and in fact wrote our manuscript, and we are very happy we're able to steal her away from you for a while at Harvard. She's going to train in surgery next year with us. So all of you, particularly the senior docs here, are well aware of the Socratic paradox, right? We only know that we know nothing, and I think many of you here are interested in doing new things. It's amazing to hear about somebody who really did one of the first migraine surgeons. What does that take to be the first? You know, it really is incredible to think about. You know, I have a group of Harvard residents who come and every Friday we do a seminar together, and I'll talk about anything they want to talk about. And in those lectures, there are two themes that often come across, right? One is that as a plastic surgeon or any doctor, there's very few things now that I do that I learned in my training. I mean, if you really think about it, the way we do breast reconstruction, facelift, there's some things that are the same, but it's quite different 10, 15 years later. And so I really want my trainees to be aware that things are gonna change. What we think is right today is not right. Some of it is, but not all of it. And your mind has to be prepared for that. On the other hand, there's a paradox, because the other thing I'm always telling them is that when we go over a case or talk about a patient, if they're coming up with something they've never seen before, either they're a genius or they're an idiot. And so this I think about this a lot, and it is a paradox as we all go through our training, right? You train until the day you retire. So I think it's important when you talk about any subject, particularly one like this, to understand where we are in the evolution of this concept. And so in plastic surgery, and many of you are plastic surgeons or training in plastic surgery, you're aware of breast reconstruction. And if you look over this 30-year period from 72 to 2002, you know, we're all scientists. We think about data. And one way to look at where we are in the field is just how many publications there were. So if you PubMed these articles, you can see the evolution of breast reconstruction. Fat grafting is more recent topic. Every meeting we go to, we're talking about fat grafting. And look at how that's evolved. We went from it being shunned by our society. I mean, there were position papers from plastic surgeons saying that fat grafting was horrible crime against humanity. And yet now, you can't go to a meeting without fat grafting being top of the chart. In migraine surgery, there's only been 40 papers. Only 40. So we're really very early, and all of us have to be aware that this discussion is a very early one in this field. Conversely, and we have at least one neurologist here, this is what they're writing about migraines. I mean, there were 1,200 articles on migraines in 1 year alone. Interesting. And yet a third of patients are either refractory or can't tolerate the therapy. So why not think about alternatives? Is there anything wrong with that? I would argue that it's certainly not wrong to try and come up with things for these patients. So what are the facts? Well, there's over 300 million patients who suffer worldwide. One in four households, certainly more women than men. It's the number 9 cause of disability of women worldwide. In America, there are 35 million migraine sufferers. The Rainbow Light, Eurolight project demonstrated about 15% of Europeans suffer from this. Over a million people in Austria, 12 million in Germany, a million in Switzerland. You know, there's a lot of patients out there. First thing I tell my patients, I am not a neurologist. I don't pretend to be a neurologist. I'm certainly aware of theories that go back more than 40 years about migraine. The main point, and certainly people here could say a lot more about this than me, is that migraine is a problem of the brain. And this is one of the reasons why some of the neurologists are somewhat negative about this. We say we're going to cure migraines. They say, how can you cure migraines? You're not operating on the brain, are you? Well, hopefully not. I have on occasion, but hopefully not. But why surgery? Well, it, like most things in medicine, it came out of observation. You've heard about some of that observation. One observation is, as I've said, there are many medications, and some of them are fine-tuned towards how we think migraine occurs. But these drugs have side effects, contraindications, and there are non-responders. You've heard already that as patients were receiving Botox, they were coming back and saying, gee, you know, doc, my migraines are better. And this has now been FDA approved in the United States and is widely used throughout Europe. Dr. Gairon, as you've heard, noted that his patients who were receiving Botox were very similar to his brow lift patients. He was doing lots and lots of endoscopic brow lift. And he went to these patients and said, gee, you know, how many of you had migraines? Well, it turns out most cosmetic plastic surgeons, about 20% of their patients are going to have migraines. They're women, a lot of women. And so when he went back, he found that of 350 brow lift patients, found a subset of them who reported migraines prior to surgery, 79% of them said they got better. And this was the paper that you've heard about. So this concept evolved. Why couldn't there be something like carpal tunnel syndrome of the head? Does it make sense to anyone here that you would only have a problem related to compression of your nerves in your hands and your feet? Why not elsewhere? I throw out this hypothesis. Well, Gairon did. And this was the idea. Couldn't there be compression or irritation of nerves that leads to inflammatory cytokines and pain that could trigger migraines? Gairon and his group then looked at these patients and did a lot of anatomic work to try and determine what the various triggers might be. Where could these compressions happen? And they essentially came up with four major trigger sites. You've heard of one, the frontal, but they also described the occipital. The concept of occipital neuralgia has been around for 60, 70 years. The temporal and the nasal. That's also something that is, you can look in the ENT literature, again, 40, 50 years and find series after series of nasal patients whose headaches get better after surgery. So these are not necessarily new ideas. In 2005, Gairon published his first prospective study where they treated patients with Botox, 100 patients, 89 of them responded to Botox, and those patients were treated surgically as they thought they should to decompress their nerves. And what they found was 92% of the patients, they reported it a year, had a 50% essential reduction of their migraine pain. 35% had total elimination of their migraines. Now the control group had 15% of essential improvement. We all know that migraine patients, pain patients have a very high placebo effect, but none of those patients had elimination. This study really got a lot of press. Wall Street Journal picked this up. Gairon did something pretty unusual in surgery and surgery literature, and what he did was a prospective sham study where he took a similar group of patients as in that first study, and he operated on all of them. But 25 of the 75 didn't actually get a real operation. Got an incision, they dissected everything out, but didn't actually release the corrugator in the nerves. And what they found was that 83% of the patients who had what I'd call real surgery had essential improvement. But 57% of the sham patients also had a 50% temporary reduction. This has been a sticking point with the neurologists. It is important to note that 50% of the patients who had the real operation had total elimination of their migraines versus only 3.8% of the sham patients. These patients were then followed for 5 years and found to have maintenance of their improvement, 88%. So up to now, you've heard there have been about 40 papers, about 30 of them have been clinical, and they've reported rates of improvement for 62 to 95%. I don't need to go over this important paper, and again, it's a great honor to hear from the guy who actually operated on Dernburger that led to this study. It's not often you do one operation, it leads to a whole field, so that's pretty neat. So what about my practice? A lot of people want to know how you get started. You know, how can something like this be around and be so great maybe and not really take off? Well, new things are hard. I actually spent time with Guyron, went to his course. He spent time with me at the Mass General, and it was pretty powerful, and I'll try to express the same excitement to you. This is a guy who, you know, flies in on his own private jet, does a lot of cosmetic surgery, pretty famous for facelifts and rhinoplasties, and all he wanted to talk about were these migraine patients. These were his happiest patients, and I'll tell you, they're still my happiest patients too. So what did I do? I was very excited, and I tried to gather a team. I'm at the Mass General. It's a really great place, and we've got wonderful pain service, neurologists, dentists, pretty good plastic surgery group. I figured this is going to be pretty easy. So in the first year, I saw 5 patients and operated on one of them. And it was pretty similar to the operation you've just seen here. It was a corrugator resection in the office. Year 2, I saw 7 patients. Operated on 2 of them. So what was the problem? Well, patient recruitment was a problem. Skepticism from the neurologists. There have been a number of statement papers in there by their society, just as we had with fat grafting a number of years ago, saying that this is horrible, that you really need to do a lot more prospective work. Patient selection. That's probably the real problem, is who to operate on. One thing I emphasize with my residents is there's nothing dumber you can do as a surgeon than take a patient with chronic pain and operate on them and not make them better. So it's critical to understand who you can help and who you can't. In our country, insurance has been an issue which we're working on. So for me, the media was important. I was always taught to avoid the press. But in this case, it actually helped. That first patient I operated on ended up on Good Morning America, which is a pretty popular national show in the U.S., and patients started showing up.
A local plastic surgeon says this provides life-changing relief. Sound too good to be true? Just ask Stacy.
Awesome is like a miracle.
It took the Mass General surgeon less than 3 hours to nearly eliminate years of debilitating migraines. She went from suffering
15 plus headaches a month
to just 3.
You've been pretty happy with your result.
I've been thrilled.
So, sort of embarrassing, but my mother loves that video, so I feel it. So, you know, what's happened since then? Well, slowly but surely, We've had hundreds and hundreds of patients' visits, as you may imagine, but slowly but surely we've increased the number of consults and surgeries. And I think what I'd like to focus on now is the patient selection. There's an art to what we do. So the first thing that I emphasize, and Guyron also, is that you can't just operate on anybody. These patients, neurologists are great, migraine specialists are great, they can really help most of these patients, and you should let them. And so it's very important that they've been followed by neurologists, that you're able to review their medical history and be pretty sure that they've tried all the appropriate therapies. So you want to establish a diagnosis and make sure that these patients are the ones you should be seeing. 2, you've got to identify a specific trigger. Just operating on the back or the front and not putting together where their pain may be originating from is probably not the way to go. And so from my point of view, there's a difference between your typical migraine patient who's going to do well with a neurologist and what we would term a nerve compression headache. And by the way, I think we've had some really good discussions with our neurologists, including the ones who've written some of these negative articles. Sometimes it's just a matter of semantics. They do not want us to say we're curing migraines. I never say I'm curing migraines. I have patients who don't have migraines anymore. What we are trying to treat is their triggers. We're trying to identify and treat triggers. So patients with nerve compression headaches, we think, are different. Migraine patients have more of a deep, undefined pain, and the starting point is unclear. Our patients hopefully have specific points that make anatomic sense to us, and they can always tell you where their pain starts. The frontal trigger, you've heard a little bit about this already, the supraorbital nerve and the supratrochlear nerve. These patients typically have pain above the eyebrows. It's tender to touch. They have a Tinel sign. Pain typically is worse in the afternoon. They look like they've got brow ptosis and pretty strong corrugators. Eyelid ptosis is common during a migraine. And pressure and compression seems to help. They'll point right to that supraorbital notch almost every time. Interestingly, Dr. Frere came up with this idea that's been very helpful for us of using these diagrams with patients. A patient who we think is a good candidate almost always gives us a really nice drawing of their pain. It's very specific. These are some less ideal drawings. These are actually all patients from Austria who we screened prior to showing up here. The temporal trigger site, this is the zygomatic temporal nerve. It's been well described anatomically. Pain starts in the temple, wakes patients up. They tend to have long face syndrome, jaw issues, they grind their teeth. The pain is often described as throbbing. And again, pressure and compression usually is reported as helping. And they'll point right to this notch. Everybody in this room, you can always find this spot. Just take your finger and it just goes right to this spot. It's 1.7 centimeters from your lateral canthus, 7 millimeters up, and you're almost always gonna find that nerve there. There's some slight variation. And their diagrams are really pretty specific. These are less ideal diagrams. Greater occipital trigger site. Again, occipital neuralgia has been around as an idea for a long time. The greater occipital nerve is the largest sensory nerve in the body. These patients have pain that starts over this site. Can happen any time of the day. I find that they tend to report it later in the day. They often have a history of trauma. They'll say that they had a car accident at some point, sort of interesting. Tight neck muscles. They'll tell you that they avoid the gym, they avoid lifting things because it'll bring on a migraine. And they often will point, there's a few places they can point, but this is the most common. And their diagrams I would call very classic. Goes around the front, right behind the eye. These are less ideal diagrams. These are patients I would worry about. The rhinogenic trigger is very, very important. A lot of patients have nasal pathology irritating the nasal palatine nerve. And these patients always report pain behind the eye. They say, gee, I have sinus headaches. It's always behind the eye. It wakes them up at night. It's very much related to weather, altitude, cycle. Decongestions help, and the CAT scans, I will never operate on a patient without a head CT or MRI. It'd be very unusual that a migraine patient wouldn't have one, but you really want to rule out intracranial pathology, other problems, or certainly nasal issues. And their diagrams, again, very classic. They'll just put an X right over the eye. There are some minor triggers. I shortened this talk today. I'm not going to talk a lot about those unless you want to, but the lesser occipital nerve is becoming more important in our thinking. These patients tend to have pain a little bit more lateral than the greater occipital nerve. It can be tricky to sort these two out. And they will often come in and say, for years I would go to my primary care doctor complaining of ear infections and they could never find anything. So pain often goes into the ear or even around to the jaw. And their diagrams, again, are fairly typical. Clinical evaluation and testing. You've heard a bit about Botox. So there's two papers that Guyron wrote that are a bit, they've led to some controversy. He first showed that injecting Botox is a good way to diagnose whether a patient's gonna respond to surgery. And I would absolutely agree. If a patient responds well to Botox, they should just get Botox. They shouldn't have surgery. The problem is that many of these patients will get Botox, it will work once or twice, only works for a month, and then if it's like it is in the US, they can't get Botox again for another 3 months, and they suffer. Many of the patients I'm seeing, it works for a while and then stops working, which is sort of interesting. So I'm sure that we're selecting out a very small group of patients. But I would agree, if Botox works, use it. You know, makes sense. Guyron then wrote another paper which compared, and again, this is a retrospective study which has a lot of problems, retrospective studies, but what he did was he compared patients who he'd operated on based on whether they responded to Botox versus their constellation of symptoms. And you got to understand his practice. Patients fly in from all over the world to Ohio. I mean, Cleveland, Ohio, unless you're going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there's not much in Cleveland. So you're coming to see Guyron for the surgery. And he just doesn't have time to do Botox and nerve blocks. And he sees them, hears their story. If he likes it, he operates on them. That's what he does. And I would think that most of us, if we had seen 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 patients, might get to the point where you don't need Botox anymore. But for everybody in this room, myself included, I strongly feel, and I've told Bauman this, that for this to make sense for me, I have to have a number of things line up, and one of them is that these diagnostic tests have to make sense to me. Ultrasound is a newer concept. In April, PRS, Guyron published on this. There's really not a lot of data there, but it's interesting. And it's particularly important with the minor triggers. And it's possible that if patients have some atypical pain, if they have a positive Doppler there, that there might be a site of compression of a particular nerve by a vessel. Here's an example of the auricular temporal. This is a patient I actually operated on, and she got better. And right where we're putting this Doppler is exactly where she always has her pain. Now, the neurologist in the room might say, that's not a migraine. And I'm not going to disagree with them. This is a woman who has pain all the time, 90% of the time, in this one area. So clearly that is part of her auricular temporal vascular tree. What did we do? We just went in and removed that neurovascular bundle. The consequences of that are essentially nothing. So we talked about CAT scan. It's critical to have a CAT scan. I always look at these myself. The radiologists do not know what we're looking for. They will often say, normal CAT scan, and you'll find a conchal bullosa or Haller cells or even a deviated septum that might be significant. Sort of interesting, we're now learning that we can probably identify anatomic variations, particularly in the supraorbital nerves. So what are my pathways? Well, I hope it's pretty clear. The history is critical. I agree with Guyron. I personally think that nerve block and Botox are also critical. If somebody doesn't respond to nerve block or Botox, I'm not going to operate on them. I've done that at the urging of Guyron, and those are the patients who are not getting better, and I don't think it makes sense. I think that Doppler and imaging are important. How important and in which patients, I can't tell you yet, but we're studying this. So if everything lines up, we operate. If it doesn't, they go back to neurology, pain service, or ENT. Interesting, patients who go back to ENT, we're looking at those patients who've had surgery, but more than 50% of them are getting better. And these are the patients who don't respond to Botox or nerve blocks. So what do we do in the operations? This is usually what the surgeons are interested in. For the posterior trigger, six compression points have been described. I'm not going to bore you with all those. I think just like other nerve decompressions, what you want to do is go find the nerve and free it up from its origin to where it ends. And that's what we do. You can do this in a number of positions. I like the prone position. My anesthetists are very into this. They love monitoring the eyes, and so they've got this fancy video system. Here you go. You inject, you incise. This incision is from the occiput down to the hairline. These patients, a week later, just can't see this. We've never had a problem with one of these scars. Dissect down to the median raphae and go to one side or the other. And what you're looking at here is a close-up of the trapezial fascia being lifted off of the capitis muscle. You find the greater occipital nerve. There it is. And you free it up. And here's a little more video. And just as you saw in the front, we free this nerve up in the back. proximally and distally. Proximally, you want to remove that cuff of muscle. That nerve courses through the muscle under the fascia, and that's a very large muscle, and you can remove the muscle around that nerve without any functional problem. And so we do that. Here's that muscle removed. And you free up the nerve. Distally, you want to look for the greater occipital artery. These patients are, I mean, you just know who they are. They have throbbing, pounding pain. When they point to their head, it's a little higher up. If you put a Doppler on it, which we're now doing on all these patients, it's always positive. It's always right where that occipital artery and nerve meet. And so you want to look for that. And it's amazing how often you'll find that artery and nerve intertwined on those patients. And here's an example of that. You can see the video, which is on a loop. Right where that greater occipital nerve splits, there's an artery just running right through it. And it tends to run through it and then run with it right up to the skin, which makes it very annoying. We then lift a inferiorly based fat flap to put under the nerve. We've learned this from the nerve surgeons. I have no data to support this. This is something Guyron taught us. But we will raise this flap to prevent that nerve from sticking back down to the muscle. And here's both sides released on this patient. Incision closed. Here's just an anatomic dissection of that lesser occipital nerve. It's actually really easy. If a patient has lesser occipital nerve symptoms, they point right to where it hurts. You make a tiny incision there. You can do this in the office. It's always there. We debate whether we release that nerve or remove it. I remove it. Makes some people crazy. I've not had any problem with that. Some of my nerve-trained surgeon friends like to dissect down to the sternocleidomastoid and free the nerve up. I think both work. On the front, Guyron really taught everybody. He certainly did transpalpebral, but really has promoted the idea of using the endoscope. I like the group here, actually favor the eyelid approach. I think it gets you right where you want to be. And you can treat all the frontal triggers through the eyelid. This is, I think, one of our technical contributions. It's something that Guyron said you probably couldn't do, but we did it, and we've written about it. Here's just a view of those nerves, endoscopically and open. And here's what we do. And you've already seen this, so we can go through it quickly, but we dissect just as we would for a blepharoplasty. I go right down under the orbicularis, down to the orbital rim. Looks pretty familiar, hasn't changed. It's interesting how we all sort of figure out how to do these things pretty much the same. Dissect down to the orbit and identify those nerves and then the corrugator. And so here's what you're looking for, the supraorbital nerve and the supratrochlear nerve. More often than not, you're finding them in a notch, and that anatomy has been described. But if you look at the picture on the right, that's a foramen. And I think anatomic studies have shown 10 to 20% of cadavers or 10 to 18% of cadavers have this foramen. I think we're going to find that our patients, that incidence is higher. And I think that is a good argument for transpalpebral, because we're actually releasing the nerve not just through the muscle but through the bone and into the orbit now. And here's a patient who needed a foramenectomy. We literally chip away that bone and release that nerve. You can see that there. You see a lot of variation here. We actually have a super trochlear and supraorbital coming through the same notch. Here's some very high supraorbital foramen. This is probably where you need to be the most careful. And we could talk offline about how to handle this, but it is possible to end up in the sinus of the brain if you don't know what you're doing. So be cautious. If you don't know where the nerve is, if you go down to the rim and can't find it, you can very quickly dissect into the orbit and see where those nerves are going, as you can see here. Here's just a couple examples of foramen. Here's a supraorbital and supratrochlear foramen. And you can see you want to look for the vessels. We don't really understand what the problem is. But I think all of us intuitively understand that when you find these nerves and vessels together, you want to get rid of the vessels. There's something about them, particularly being trapped together, that's probably part of the problem. Here you go, there's nerve and vessel. There are aberrant nerves. Here's an example of a aberrant superorbital nerve that just shouldn't be there. And in one small series, they had 100% improvement on patients where this was found. Again, I think another reason to really release that orbit. So the anatomy of these nerves has been well described, but I would agree with my colleague, the key is to simply dissect them free. And here's what we do. We expose those depressor muscles. And as you've seen in his video, the earlier one's probably better than this one. I find this really hard to do. To get the good video, I mean. But here, we're doing exactly the same thing. I'm just not using the bipolar. And once you release those nerves, here's something that you guys probably weren't doing, and we have no idea if it makes sense or not, but it does intuitively. We're wrapping fat, and this is vascularized fat from the around the orbit. And here's just an example. It takes you about 3 seconds to raise this flap up and wrap it around the nerve. So zygomaticotemporal nerve, again, very well described. You do get a great view of this endoscopically. But we figured, why can't you do this through the eyelid? And so we worked on it and found that we could. And you can see that mark, that purple mark, is right where the zygomatical nerve should be. That's where the pain is. And we've got an instrument going right to it. And here you can see the sentinel vein. Every surgeon here knows how important that is. That helps you identify where the facial nerve is going to be found. So you really want to know where that is. So you dissect the sentinel vein, and then you go a little bit farther, and you find this little nerve. Here it is subfascial. I go suprafascial. Everybody asks me, well, gee, you know, wouldn't it be safer to go subfascial? But you can do it. It tends to be a bit more bloody, and often can be challenging, but it can be done. And here it is superfascial. Here's just a video of how we do that. It's very similar to approaching it from the temple. You just have to dissect over that deep temporal fascia, push up the superficial layer. Here you see that sentinel vein coming into view. And there's the nerve. I mean, this nerve is inconsequential, except it seems to be causing pain in some patients. You know, every kid who gets a coronal approach loses this nerve without any consequence. There it is. So we have written on our work. This was an early series. I really had no interest in writing this paper, but Bauman actually pushed me to get this out because it, I think, was interesting to him and others. And Dr. Frere put this together remarkably. And you know, what we found with this early series of 35 patients followed for a year was that if you looked at their migraine headache frequency, it went from 18 to 3.7. The duration went down from almost 17 hours to 5 hours. And on average, their pain scale went from 9 to 3. So their index went from 99 to 10. 90% reduction. And if you look at the individual patients, over 90% of these patients had a greater than 50% reduction in their migraine headache index. If you look at the patients that did well, 80% of them were between 80 and 100%. So when it works, it really works pretty darn well. So how do we manage these patients postoperatively? Well, they actually do pretty well. As you've heard, they do have problems with numbness and sensation coming back, this feeling of tightness, shooting pains. You see this in almost every patient. I found that it's only been horrible in a few, and it always gets better. We do have Neurontin. We've learned to use this, and it does work well. We've had no other major complications. We have had two patients in a few hundred who had a transient frontal nerve palsy, which is pretty similar to those getting endoscopic, and that's almost certainly from retraction or maybe even from injection, but nothing permanent. So how else do we manage them? Well, we treat them like any other surgical patient. You give them pain medicine, and you encourage them to get the word out. You encourage them to go back to the neurologist. I don't know what it's like here. It's been challenging. My neurologist won't see the patient again. I mean, they literally will say, don't come back if you have surgery. Not all of them, just some, but you can imagine how disturbing that is to the patient and to us. We certainly encourage them to speak to their neurologist, whether they do well or poorly, to help people understand what this is about. So we've talked a lot about art. We're all interested in science. Admittedly, it is early days, but we can't move forward without really looking at our patients and looking at our data critically, and that's what we're doing. We've got a lot of questions. I'm sure you all have many, many, many questions, things we should look at, think about. We're trying. Is it working? We've shown you a retrospective study. How's it working prospectively? Is there a better way to evaluate our results and communicate them to you and everybody else? Is there a better way to screen? You know, it seems like we're doing pretty well, but is there a simple test we can give patients to help people, particularly when they're starting out, when you haven't seen 2,000 patients, to understand who might be a good candidate and who isn't? So we've got this idea of a migraine cue. Those of you who are plastic surgeons know about cues, and the idea is to have an instrument to help you with screening and evaluation for these particular patients. You know, questions are powerful. I think everybody knows about the breast cue. And we certainly have lots of questionnaires around migraine and pain. The real question is, are they relevant to these particular type of patients? I would argue that they may not be. What we'd ultimately like to have is a tool with a score. If a patient answers a certain amount of questions, not an hour of questions, but maybe a condensed group of questions, could we help discuss with the neurologist and our colleagues who we think is going to consistently get better and who's not? And we think that this will be important. We also want to know, be able to show patients and docs how patients are doing. Is the migraine headache index really the best tool out there? I don't know. It's what we have. So what are we doing? Well, we're using all the studies that the migraine doctors would use now, that we've used now, and we're using some other tools that are pretty well described in the chronic pain literature. And it's been really pretty interesting. Firstly, how are we doing prospectively? Well, we're doing okay. If you look at our migraine headache index frequency on our prospective group, and we've now got over 150 patients enrolled in this study, the frequency's gone down from 19 to 2.4 at 12 months. That's pretty good. The duration's gone down from 23 hours to 7 hours, and the severity from 8.3 to a 3.5. So, our migraine headache index has gone down at a year by 93%. If you compare this to our prospective study, it's very similar. About 90% of the patients are essentially improved. And if you look at the group that did well, again, about 80% of those that do well do really well. A couple of interesting things have come out of this. I think that this was actually directly out of Dernberger's paper, and we found the exact same thing. And that was, if a patient does well at 3 months, they're doing well at 12 months. Those of you who study other pain problems know about pain self-efficacy. It's pretty well known in back pain and carpal tunnel pain and other pain syndromes that if pain self-efficacy is bad, patients don't tend to do well. What's pain self-efficacy? It's patients' ability to do activities of daily living. You know, can you clean the house? Can you go to work? You know. And so if you have low pain self-efficacy, you don't do well. So we wanted to look at how these patients do with migraine. And also, we wanted to put these patients in context, right? How do you compare a migraine patient to a back pain patient? And how do you compare your results to somebody who gets spine surgery? Well, in the U.S., if you get back pain, they'll operate on you. They'll cover it by insurance. Well, how is what we're doing relate to that? Maybe that's a better way to get across our point. And it's interesting, if you look at our pain self-efficacy, our patients are horrible pre-op. I mean, their pain self-efficacy is a 19. Compared that to chronic back pain in the US, 38 is really good. Carpal tunnel is 48. If your self-efficacy is 40, your ability to do well and cope is really pretty good, right? So carpal tunnel, right, you do fine with carpal tunnel. Chronic back pain, maybe you're not doing so fine. Migraines, you're not doing very well. And these are the patients, but hold on, these are the patients who come to see me, so we're seeing the worst of the worst. If you operate on patients with carpal tunnel, they do a little better. They go from a 48 to a 52. If you operate on chronic back pain, they go from a 38 to a 43. Our patients go from a 19 to 47. I mean, this is unheard of in pain literature. And so we think that there's something really interesting here, and perhaps a new way to really look at these patients and show people how they're doing. Other interesting questions, and there are many, we could talk about a lot of them. What matters? Well, actually, age of onset matters. And patients who develop their migraines greater than 40, half of them don't do so well. Younger than 40 do pretty well. Really interesting. Duration of pain is a big deal. If patients have 50 hours of pain routinely, they don't do so well. Other predictive variables. Don't ask me why. Patients who get nausea do pretty well. Patients who are bothered by sunlight and noise do pretty well. And this is statistically significant in our early data. Now, will this hold up after we do 500, 1,000 patients? I don't know, but it's really pretty interesting. How about if they're relieved by certain things? Again, patients with cold, compression, quiet, they tend to do better with surgery too. It's really interesting. Here's the data. I mean, there's real differences. If cold compresses don't help, they don't get better. Well, there's a lot of other questions and a lot of other early things that we're working on. Wouldn't it be great to understand why this happens in these patients? Are there other modalities we can use to better assess these patients? Just to name a few. So we have developed a migraine tissue bank. All these patients have tissue that gets removed, would otherwise be thrown away. We're saving it. We're hoping at some point in the future we can be doing proteomic studies to try and understand, are there differences in these patients? We're using things like thermal imaging. No idea how useful this is going to be, but we're just seeing really interesting things. This is a patient who says she gets pain exactly where that white is. You see that white? Now, I mean, it's some kind of parasympathetic thing going. She doesn't have a migraine now. She thinks she's about to have one. And it sort of shows up on this image. Whether we can use this to screen patients or help patients, maybe the neurologist could use this to help patients know when they should take their medication or not. I don't know, but it's sort of intriguing stuff. We've actually been able to predict whether patients have a supraorbital foramen or not. So, maybe you could save a patient a 3D CT with this. Who knows? So I hope I've stimulated your thinking on this. Maybe some discussion. I'm very grateful for your attention, and really couldn't be more honored to be here today.